or pastor. And if two people are going to live together and take up housekeeping together, it's a good thing for each to have a clear notion of the rights and duties that each has towards the other. And do not demand that I demonstrate all the social graces, he went on, or that I be worldly wise or a flashy speaker, or anything else other than a servant of the true teaching. Take care that what is said from this your pulpit, and watch jealously that it is not being profaned. The parish that requires nothing of its pastor is asleep, but the one that requires much is alive. The first premise for beneficial cooperation is an unreserved and mutual give and take between us. We shouldn't say, here are the parishioners and there is a pastor, but rather, we together. This is my task. Pastor Boda tried to make the lessons in the schools more interesting and checked to see that the teachers really began lessons on time. He himself organized programs for official school celebrations. He arranged for the children to be provided with their school books, with the exception of Bible and Psalm book, at the cost of the school district. He advocated putting an atlas and a book on science and languages in the hand of each pupil, and he considered sports and gymnastics to be one of the most important subjects. It was Pastor Boda, with his farmers, that in 1888 founded the first savings and loan bank in the Lüneburger Heide. Later, a cooperative for the insurance of farm animals, the Kuhkasse, or Cow Fund, was added. The cooperative purchase of feed and fertilizer was organized, followed by a water cooperative, which used wind power to provide the village with running water. This was one side of his work, practical, active help, so that the people entrusted to him could improve their standard of living. Pastor Boda's other side seems marked by a sort of natural piety. His sermons breathe the air of freedom and nature. His passion for the heath is not an ideology. Rather, it was a part of his pastoral teaching to win each of his farmers to an appreciation of the land that he farmed. On a walking trip with his father, the young Boda had passed from Egerstorf via Auer and Radenbach to Wilseder, through the untouched natural beauty of the open heath with its juniper bushes, with the lustrous dark green of the bordering pine woods. At one point, his father said, "My son, if a man could preserve this landscape for future generations, he would have accomplished a great work, a good work." Many years later, when Boda found that a considerable parcel of land, the Totengrund, was to be sold and used for construction, he tried to prevent the sale. After many fruitless attempts, he found a valuable ally in Professor Thompson from Munster. This man was prepared to supply funds for the purchase of the Totengrund, thus saving it from the development that threatened it. After very difficult negotiations, Boda succeeded in purchasing the Totengrund in 1906 for the sum of 6,000 marks. This piece of land was to become the seed from which the Lüneburger Heath Nature Park was to grow. The Lüneburger Heath Nature Park was to grow. Boda carried out his next project in cooperation with Herr Dagerführer, a teacher from Tangendorf. This teacher had assembled an extensive anthropological collection which filled the schoolhouse to overflowing. On the initiative of Pastor Boda, a piece of land was purchased in Wilseder. Thus, Boda became one of the founders of the Wilseder Heath Museum Society. Dagerführer acquired quite cheaply. Yes. Dr. Schreiber has a telephone call, please. Dr. Schreiber. Hans Schreiber, I guess that is. Dagerförder acquired quite cheaply, as it was going to be torn down, a fine old farmhouse in Hanstedt, dating from 1750. This house was disassembled and then rebuilt on the lot in Wilseder. It opened on August the 15th, 1907, as the old house, or in the North German idiom, have a go at that, Dat Ulle Hus. Tourism increased. The society, only recently formed, enthusiastically erected an inn, the Inn at the Heath Museum. Pastor Boda wrote the advertising pamphlets himself and argued, no paved road, no Nickelodeon. As Pastor Boda learned that a dance hall was to be built on Wilseder Hill, he managed to delay the sale of the land. District Councillor Ecker from Vinson Lewer, a member of the Nature Park Society, sent the author of Cosmos, Dr. Kurt Flüricker, to look over the situation. Impressed, Flüricker wrote a decisive report. Ecker, as representative in the Prussian legislature, succeeded in arranging for public funds to be made available. The Nature Park Society was then able to purchase this parcel as well. When Pastor Buddha died on June the 10th, 1927, he was mourned by a large number of people. It was his request that his ashes be scattered to the winds from the top of the Vilseda Hill. This wish was granted him.
Well, until 10 minutes ago, I didn't know anything about Pastor Bode and his good works, but I do know a little about Ab Mitchison and his good works, and Rolf asked me to say just a few words by way of introduction to Av's lecture, and I think it's appropriate if we could keep the picture of Pastor Bode up, because the first thing that strikes me is that there are some similarities between... First of all, between Pastor Bode's character and interests and humanitarianism and Av's, and also his appearance, I have to say, somewhat plus or minus the beard. Those of you who have been coming to this meeting as long as I have will know that Av is just as much a fixture of this meeting at Wilsetter as is Rolf, and I can't imagine this meeting without either of them. Av has an enormous generosity of spirit, a mischievous sense of humor, and a love of intellectual inquiry that I think is also characteristic of this meeting and explains why so many people come here year after year and always enjoy it so much. I first came in 76 when Av invited me and have continued to come ever since, despite the fact that on the first occasion I was forced to share a bed with a Hungarian. Now, there are many people in this room who've, including myself, who've benefited over the years from Av's remarkable encouragement and support that he gives to young scientists. And I think this is all the more extraordinary because there's never ever been the slightest hint that he's sought any credit. And I think this makes him an extremely unusual and remarkable and much loved scientist. A year ago in London, there was a celebration of Av's 60th birthday, and people came from all four quarters of the earth to celebrate that. And everybody came in a spirit of goodwill, wishing to see and talk with Av. And I can't think of any better compliment a scientist can have than to know that a room is full with people who have just loved to come and talk to him. I think it's a remarkable tribute to him as a person. I'd like to say, in fact, I'm tempted to say that Av is sort of the last in a long line of English gentlemen scientists, but actually this isn't true, and the reason it's not true is that his genealogy goes back to villainous Scottish lairds and kings who did dark deeds on dark heaths 1,000 years ago, in places rather like Vilseder, I might add. So I suppose it goes to show that genes aren't everything. As I said, Av has been enormously helpful to a whole generation of young scientists, many of whom are here. But it's not that long ago that he was a young scientist himself, of course, and came under the influence of a number of interesting and brilliant characters. And I happen to have a picture of, let's immortalize those early days in Oxford. Can I have the next slide, please? Second slide, which Av will recall me showing last year. It's a favorite slide of mine for a number of reasons. But this recalls halcyon days in Oxford after the Second World War, when there was a cohort of really outstanding and brilliant scientists. Oxford was the natural home for them. The natural spiritual home has moved to University College London, but in those days it was in Oxford. I don't know who, Ad must tell me who this is and this is, but we've got here Karl Popper, a philosopher scientist. These are all friends together. It's quite extraordinary. Karl Popper here. J.Z. Young, who was an outstanding and Britain's top zoologist, perhaps. Wrote an outstanding textbook that all of us young zoologists were forced to read and enjoyed reading, although told to read, Expert on the Octopus Brain, J.Z. Young. This is a young, fresh-looking Peter Medawar, Sir Peter Medawar, one of the founding fathers of immunology. Actually, I was also fortunate enough to be taught immunology by EC. That's the reason I got into immunology. But look over here. This, I assure you, this is young Nicholas Avrion Mitchison. And you can see he really hasn't changed at all. I mean, except perhaps that he now there's quite a more benign smile on his face with the passage of time, but otherwise nothing has changed. But what I'd like to do now is to invite the young Avrion to come and give us his talk on Escape from the Red Queen.
Mel, thank you very much. I'm very nearly reduced to silence, but not quite by your very kind words. Apropos Pastor Boda, may the days return when scientists and greens were good friends. There's been a misunderstanding in this decade, but may that day return before long. It's a misunderstanding. And with a better understanding, we can be friends with the Greens again. At least I hope so. Yes, could we have the slide off? Thank you. I'm going to discuss with you today a genetic phenomenon. I'm going to ask why it occurs, and then I'm going to ask how it occurs. And then I'm going to ask, can we make use of it in order to understand and eventually control human disease? And the phenomenon in question is illustrated very nicely here, I think, by what may be the best paper ever to emerge from Venezuela on immunology, a joint study with the Leiden group of HLA typers. And it is a study on families in Venezuela with multiple cases of Lepromatous leprosy. And what you see is a conventional designation of these families, of parents, as AB for the two haplotypes of the mother, and C and D, the two haplotypes of the father, and then the typing of the children, you see that we start with A, B, C, and D, but E's and F's creep into these families of the peasantry in Venezuela. The major point which you see is that in the families of multiple cases of leprosy, of Lepromatous leprosy, you see the sharing of a single haplotype. Actually, this should be underlined here. You see in this first family that all the diseased individuals share the D haplotype. And in the next family, they all share the C haplotype, and so on. And that runs through a set of families, and you can you have to do some hairy statistics to calculate the significance of this association, but it turns out to be highly significant, indicating that a single haplotype can confer predisposition to disease. Now, of course, that doesn't tell you anything about how the gene concerned operates, but the fact that the sharing is for an MHC haplotype suggests that it's got something to do with the immune system, and the fact that the haplotype predisposes for disease, for an infectious disease, suggests it's got something to do with inhibition of the immune response. And I use the term immune IS, or immune suppression genes, in a very general sense here, to indicate a gene which can interfere with the activity of the immune response. Now, over the last 5 or 10 years, many other examples of this kind of dominant effect, where a single gene appears to exert an inhibitory effect on the immune response, have been discovered. The next slide, please. We go through here a rough history of the subject in man. Classical study was carried out by Sasazuki and his colleagues in Kyushu on the familial distribution of hypersensitivity to cryptomeria, to cedar pollen, which is very widely distributed in Japan. There are said to be, on the average, 100 grains of pollen per square meter over the whole of Japan. So there's a very high exposure to this allergen. And the presence of a single dominant protective gene protects individuals against this form of pollinosis. Now, we know that there are also immune response genes, principally from American studies, in which we can see evidence of the more conventional, dominantly inherited immunological responsiveness, where MHC genes are up to their usual stuff of presenting a foreign antigen to the immune system and stimulating a positive response. And it's likely that the difference in the genetics seen in Japan and America reflects, first of all, this very high exposure. And high exposure will tend, if you think about it, to identify protective genes, whereas the lower level of pollinosis seen in the United States focuses attention on susceptibility genes. But it may also be that the HLA alleles are, of course, haplotypes are different from one another in the United States and Japan. Well, then, the study which I've just referred to on Lepromatous leprosy in the previous slide, the further studies by the Sasazuki group, which identify a particular DQ allele as controlling the antibody response to a virus, again, dominantly inherited immunological unresponsiveness. As we move on down the list, we find work a little later in the United States identifying an HLA-DQ polymorphism which protects against insulin-dependent diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. That's been traced down, as I think many people know, by the McDevitt group to a single arginine residue at position 57 in the HLA-DQ molecule, which confers dominant resistance. Well, then, further work analyzing the mechanism of unresponsiveness seems to be mediated by CD8 T cells, in spite of its control by a class 2 gene. These class 1 restricted T cells are the mediators of the response. As we'll see, it's entirely possible that this form of control represents an idiotypic response on the part of CD8 T cells, recognizing peptides of the receptor, which recognizes the class 2 restricted response, the class 2 restricted antigens. Then the remarkable effect of antisera to monoclonal antibodies to HLA-DQ, where as the DQ anti-DQ antibody is titrated into a T-cell proliferation assay, instead of turning off the response, the usual effect of anti-class 2 antibodies is to silence proliferation. In these exceptional cases, antibodies to the DQ molecule increase the proliferative response, suggestive of their turning off some kind of suppressive response, which is would otherwise take place in the cultures. And that's been seen for leprosy, schistosomiasis in the hepatitis system I mentioned, and in the polynosis system. And most of those, most of that work has been carried out just by the Sazuzuki group, and like all science, it would be worrying if all the positive experiments were carried out by a single group. And it's good to be able to report that here an offspring of the Leiden group, Tom Ottenhoff, working in Addis Ababa, has been able to confirm the Sazuzuki effect in leprosy, this relief of the response produced by anti-DQ antibodies. On the other hand, there is other evidence of involvement of the DR genes in dominant unresponsiveness. For example, leprosy clones, suppressor clones restricted by DR, which De Vries and his colleagues have studied in Leiden. I should mention, I think, the very extensive literature now on protective MHC alleles, class 2 MHC alleles in rheumatoid arthritis, which is perhaps the commonest autoimmune disease in man, where, as is very well known, certain D4 types, HLA DR4 types, are immune response genes, confer an enhanced risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis. So also does DR1 in some populations, whereas HLA-DR2 appears to mediate, again, protection against the disease, possibly mediated through, again, through immunological unresponsiveness. Now, the next slide, please, goes on to mouse systems. I think we'll have to move on fairly quickly through these. I get to come back to some of these effects a little bit later, but in numerous systems, which I'm going to come back to later, the presence of an H2E molecule mediates dominantly inherited immunological unresponsiveness. In some, but not all of these instances, analysis has been carried out in the same way that Sazuzuki taught us with anti-HLA-DQ antibodies, titrating in anti-H2E monoclonal antibody relieves inhibition in a proliferation assay. But in some cases, there's no evidence H2E-mediated suppression. For example, Kishimoto's group has shown that an H2E transgene will protect mice against a mouse model, in the NOD mouse, against a mouse model of diabetes, and there's no evidence that they can find at all of suppression in that system. And as, of course, is now very well known, an alternative possibility is that the H2E molecule is deleting part of the T-cell repertoire, in particular the V-beta-8 group of T-cell receptor genes. And indeed, recent work from Yale, from Charlie Janeway's group, suggests that this is the effect which is operating in the transgenic situation. I must say that there's an enormous amount of argument about H2E molecules and V-beta-8, the role of V-beta-8 in this mouse model of insulitis, and the Janeway work has been and is challenged at present, so the record isn't in yet about that. And finally, I mention here a phenomenon which I'm going to describe in some detail in the second part of this talk, where this allele, H2AB, now that's nothing to do with E, that's the other class 2 MHC molecule in the mouse, one particular allele there controls or mediates dominant unresponsiveness. Okay, so that is a phenomenon. We can now move on to a discussion of why. Next slide, please, is borrowed from Roland Mertelsmann. You showed it yesterday. He flashed it on the screen rather quickly. And I thought it was such a nice slide, and it made exactly the point that I wanted to make, that he's very kindly lent, or possibly even given it to me, because he's now disappeared from the meeting. The point here is that in resistance to both microbes and autoimmunity, the immune system has to strike some kind of balance between the adverse effects of tissue destruction and the beneficial effects of antimicrobial activity. And I'm going to argue with you, I'm going to suggest a serious possibility that it's in order to combat tissue destruction that these inhibitory effects are observed. Or to put it a little bit more precisely, that the genes which mediate immunological unresponsiveness are preserved in the population, or their effects are preserved in the population by selection, natural selection against tissue destruction. And that selection can be mediated either by autoimmunity or by infection. But I think I have little doubt that the main selective force is microbial infection, on the grounds that autoimmunity is very uncommon and also tends to affect people past the reproductive age. And finally, there's a lot of Mertelsmannism here about cytokines, and I think he's actually dead right about that, as I'll show you later on. Next slide, please. It's kind of my version of his slide, but which reflects a position which I believe to be rather general in chronic infectious disease, the major tropical diseases, which represent certainly the greatest challenge to immunology in the next decade or two. Typically, in tropical disease, you see protective immunity, protecting some individuals in the population and limiting the growth and spread of parasites used in the largest sense to include bacteria and viruses. And typically, in an endemic area, many individuals carry a parasite load. They are the individuals who are infective to their fellows. They're the way the parasite is spread, so they're, in a certain sense, a social hazard. And the high parasite load is associated with immunological unresponsiveness. Now, the prototype disease for this situation is undoubtedly Lepromatous leprosy, the condition that we saw analyzed genetically in the first slide, but I believe it to be true of the other major infections. For example, in malaria, the recent very careful studies in jointly between Ceylon and Edinburgh indicate substantial immunological unresponsiveness associated with a high parasite load. And equally, it's when the malarial conditions which take people into hospital in the tropical areas are often associated with hypersensitivity and morbidity and mortality in the zone in between protective immunity and immunological unresponsiveness, rather than with the parasite load themselves. For example, again, from malaria, it's interstitial hypersensitivity in the kidney, which is a major cause of renal disease in the Gambia. And you could tell very much the same story for filariasis and elephantiasis of a hypersensitivity condition in this middle zone. And the next slide illustrates this point for intermediate leprosy. This individual has the characteristic signs of leprosy hypersensitivity, the thickening of the nerve trunks here. And it's that kind of symptom which is life-threatening, rather than the the vast proliferation of the mycobacterium, which takes place in subcutaneous tissue in the lepromatous leper, that's good for spreading the disease, but it's not a life-threatening condition. This, in a certain sense, from a genetic point of view, this individual has very bad luck. Next slide, please. I'd like to mention, I think, a really nice study published from basically from Zandil Cohn's group in the Rockefeller, jointly with the Amar Hansen Research Institute in Addis Ababa in the Journal of Experimental Medicine last autumn, which hinges on the kind of picture that I drew before, and in which small doses of IL-2 are injected just under the skin lesions, which, and they've been shown to, so to speak, move people to the left towards protective immunity in the local lesion. This slide is meant is a diagrammatic one. It's meant to illustrate the benefits and also the hazards of that kind of treatment. I don't know that that kind of treatment is going to do the lepromatous leper very much good. An individual here who's getting near the hypersensitivity end of the spectrum is at risk from this type of treatment, and certainly that kind of in that kind of local treatment with cytokines, the possibility of reverse reactions in the skin, hypersensitivity reactions, which are actually a normal feature of the development of the disease, are certainly a hazard. But this individual may just be moved out of the hypersensitivity zone over into protective immunity by this type of treatment. Now, I show this slide for two reasons. One, because I think it's a really nifty study, and it shows the first successful use of a cytokine in a major tropical disease. And secondly, it's got a lesson to the leukemia, well, to the cancer doctors who give doses of IL-2 of the order of over 1,000 times as much as was used in this study. This is an approximately physiological use of IL-2, in contrast to the vast amounts which are used in LAK therapy, or hoped for LAK therapy. Right. Now, to move on a little bit from the why questions to the how question, the next slide, please. No, wait a moment. I'm going to stick with the genetics for a minute. I want to develop the theme of a selection on for immunological unresponsiveness. And when you get to be as long in a subject as I have been, you're allowed to show slides as oversimplified as this. But it's undoubtedly true that the MHC, as it's revealed in its full glory by molecular genetics, turns out to be littered with pseudogenes and genes with reduced expression. And we've got to explain that in some kind of way. The next slide, please. And Sergei Rodin yesterday, who I entirely agree with in his contention that these polymorphisms, the major polymorphisms of the immune system, including the MHC and also including the immunoglobulin and T-cell receptor genes, are driven by what he drew as a dog chasing a sausage held out on the end of a stick. And I draw as the Red Queen. Now, the Red Queen is not a term that I've invented. It's used by evolutionary biologists nowadays to describe a situation in which one species evolves in parallel with another species. They're competing with one another. It may be a predator-prey relationship, as he described, for bacteriophages and bacteria, or it may be protective immunity between HLA molecules and parasites, as But the general effect is to drive evolution in an expensive, but in a certain sense, utterly ineffective way, because they both evolve, but they never get anywhere. And if they did, if one of them was to win the race, then they simply wouldn't be here. The fact that we are here and our parasites are here tells us that they are running hand in hand. And I like to show this slide for another reason, because it illustrates the fact that these days, from Moscow, or I should say from Novosibirsk to the west coast of Great Britain, we are all Euro men and Euro women, but childhood is still sacred. Childhood is still part of our nationalities, and long may it remain so. This is part of the Anglophone childhood. I know that there are just as good stories in Russian and German. Indeed, I very much enjoyed the pictures which Hans Staus showed at the beginning of his talk, as I think did all the Anglophone members of this audience, and everybody else too. Yes, so next slide, please. So genes enter the MHC gene pool because parasite epitopes evolve, and the MHC pool has to keep moving to catch up, and it moves by increasing polymorphism, by mutation, and it moves by increasing the number of loci in the MHC gene pool by gene duplication. However, the MHC gene pool can't go on expanding indefinitely. Principally, it's now believed, because T cells, because MHC molecules cut or punch giant holes in the T cell repertoire. Each MHC molecule, in the terminology of Kapler and Marek, is a superantigen. It binds many self-peptides, and as a consequence, it acts as a superantigen, and substantially, each MHC molecule substantially depletes the T cell repertoire. And so you can't carry too many genes in your pool. So just as new alleles and new loci enter the gene pools, so they are also forced to exit from the pool. Now, the eventual exit, it is likely, and this is all very speculative now, is likely to be associated with two steps. One of them is reduced expression of MHC molecules, and therefore restriction of fewer T cells. And the second feature will be reduced polymorphism, because the lower the polymorphism in a heterozygote, the lower the chances of heterozygosis, and therefore the smaller the hole in the repertoire. And that is likely, I would argue, to be associated with dominantly inherited immunological unresponsiveness produced either by immune suppression function, inhibitory function, or by negative selection, by holes punched in the T cell repertoire. And the reasoning is as follows. The MHC is operating up here, so the drive is for polymorphism, and that is because the parasite and the host have contradictory agendas. The host is trying to protect itself against the parasite is trying to grow in the host. They don't share a common agenda. But down here, they do share a common agenda. Unresponsiveness is advantageous to the parasite, and as I suggested in the previous slides, it may also be advantageous to the host through reduction in hypersensitivity. And for that reason, these genes with reduced expression and reduced polymorphism are likely to attract dominantly inherited immunological unresponsiveness. So there's a sort of linkage between these three, as in the way that I've depicted here. And you see these arrows which go to and fro, which are basically a sign that, in a certain sense, I don't know what I'm talking about. Sergei Rodin, I need the help of a theoretician. We need the help of a theoretician somewhere down here. The Red Queen is out of play here. She's in action up here. Okay, that's quite enough about why, speculative evolutionary arguments. Let's talk about what tends to interest immunologists and cell biologists much more, which is the how question. Next slide, please. Well, as I suggested, dominant unresponsiveness is likely to break down into two components. One of them is inhibitory effects, where the H2E molecule restricts a set of T cells which mediate inhibition and deletion of the T cell repertoire. I quote a number of instances here. I'm not going to go through all these examples, but I do put in a little advert here for quite a large review, which David Oliveira and I have just published in Clinical and Experimental Immunology last year. It's clear that you need different kinds of experiments to investigate these two possibilities. Here, cell mixing or relief of suppression by anti-CD8 or anti-H2E antibodies. And over here, clearly what's called for is direct studies of V gene usage of exactly the type which Amanda Fisher proposed for her lovely thymus system in the first talk this morning. The next slide, please. Oh, now, a word about how inhibitory T cells might work. I put up here a slide which was a message about suppression from Berlin, from the last International Congress of Immunology last summer in Berlin. And it's essentially the Mossman notion that the T cell differentiates into two or more directions. Here, his terminology of Th1 and Th2. And there are mutually inhibitory factors here. Th1 cells suppress release interferon gamma, which suppresses the activity of Th2 cells, as shown, I think, particularly well by Burton from and Ellen Vitetta in Dallas. The inhibitory effects in the other direction from IL-4, studied by Strylein and his group, and from a new molecule called at the time of Berlin CSIF, and now cloned as IL-10 by the DNAX group, by Mossman and his colleagues DNAX. So that's these are clearly inhibitory lymphokines which deserve much closer study. IL-10, I'm told, is not really accessible to most of us yet because DNAX still have the probes, I don't think they haven't certainly reported on an antibody against CSIF2. But that's going to be a great focus of attention in the future. Now, I'd like to emphasize that that there are all sorts of problems with this as a general explanation of dominant unresponsiveness. There's the involvement of the network that I mentioned earlier, and many of the classic suppressor effects seen in various mouse systems are being interpreted in terms of CD8 cytotoxic cells, which recognize processed T-cell suppressors. There are powerful experiments with T-cell peptides generating suppression in man, the Van der Beek experiments and Hood experiments in various autoimmune models in mice. And then, of course, there are major questions about how what is shown here as an activation state relates to the kind of lineage markers which restriction by one MHC molecule or another would imply. It's very difficult to see, it's not obvious how DQ versus DR might be associated with these different directions. But all the same, I think it's the combination of lineage markers with activation markers it's not hard to imagine how that could happen. And finally, there's a major question of the extent to which this kind of scheme applies in man. I think it's generally agreed now that Th1 and Th2 cells can be picked up when T cells are cloned from man, but they represent at present a minor subset of all the clones which can be isolated. So there's a lot to explore in this direction. The next slide, please, is to show what I believe is a kind of rather powerful experiment that one can do in mice. Here we have mice of a non-responder phenotype of mediated by dominant unresponsiveness. And we can transfer cells potentially into an irradiated host of responder phenotype, and we get in that experiment very different predictions for the hole in the repertoire hypothesis versus the inhibitory T cells hypothesis. One predicts non-response here, the other predicts a response. So that's an experiment to be done sometime in the future. Now, I'd like to just take you through one final group of experiments, because this was the stage we were at, say, at the beginning of last year, and there were really two options at that point. One of them was to take E-mediated suppression and try to analyze it in the kinds of ways that I've mentioned, looking at lymphokines or looking in these kind of transfer experiments. And the other was to go on hunting for situations in the situation, arginine in position 57 rather than something else, where that's just one example, but it looks as though there are many examples in man where allelic substitution mediates suppression rather than gene expression or not. So we went on hunting in mice. The next slide, please, illustrates an experiment in the response to congenic Phi-1-1. That's a beautiful antigen to work with, very easy to titrate the responses, very attractive antigen. And what you see here is that using congenic Phi-1 and looking at these crosses, when you bring in this end of the MHC, and if you forget about the class 1 molecule, the D class 1 molecule, it's the presence of and at the class 2A locus, the presence of a B allele seems to not to inhibit the response, but to prevent it going on upwards. So that was a little experiment with little groups of mice. And the next slide, please, shows a much bigger experiment with giant groups of mice. And in order to achieve levels of statistical significance, you need over 20 mice. Actually, this is an experiment with 160 mice in it. By the time you reach those, you start seeing statistically significant inhibition mediated by, we believe, by this AB allele. As I say, the D allele still needs to be excluded. A mouse strain which was mentioned by Rosa Moiska, but was not readily available to us, has a crossover which would let us explore D versus A. But I think that's a minor issue. The major point is that the presence of this allele suppresses the response, but only by about 40%. One thing that you see, I wanted to show this data because it shows how when you look at this kind of rather delicately poised allo response, you begin to see a feature which is characteristic of autoimmune disease in man, namely higher responses in females than in males. That's almost now a defining criterion of anything which is purports to be a model for future studies on autoimmunity. The next slide, please, illustrates a much more powerful suppression in another allo response, this time to F liver protein. It's an old friend. If you looked at the data on this side and split the mice which have AB, which are below the line, and the mice which don't have AB above the line, you could immediately, it looks as though pretty much the presence of an AB suppresses the response altogether, with these minor exceptions in the last experiment. If you look at quantitative ELISAs, many of these mice make a pretty small response, but the average difference here is two orders of magnitude. So this response is being suppressed 99% looks as though it's being suppressed 99% by the AB presence of an AB allele. Next slide, please. So that summarizes all this. The older pattern of E-mediated unresponsiveness shown here, number of antigens, this is a classical Klein study of these various other ones, where the presence of an EK molecule here confers unresponsiveness. This is a hybrid E molecule which doesn't confer unresponsiveness, possibly because it doesn't match the AB allele, possibly because it's B at the more polymorphic locus, or for other reasons which we don't understand. But here are three responses, Thy1 and F that I've mentioned, and this is a response studied by jointly between us and Juraj Ivanyi, where the P14 protein from Mycobacterium tuberculosis has the same pattern of dominant unresponsiveness, apparently mediated by the presence of the AB allele. The next slide, please. Well, this kind of is where we stand. The fact that we can pick up this rather low degree of inhibition, in a way, is very encouraging because it makes it worthwhile to look at autoimmune disease models where the we're not going to expect the pinpoint control that you can see with these single antigens, but it gives us the confidence to go on. And on the other hand, the 99% inhibition of the anti-F liver response is going to be useful for analyzing mechanisms in the way that I described earlier. And the last slide just summarizes again what we've said, that if you combine a given lot of immune response genes, both inside the MHC and outside the MHC, you have a reasonable chance then, by using these combinations of genes, to screen for protective or beneficial alleles, both in the MHC and outside. And that kind of analysis is applicable to autoimmunity of the F liver protein, as I've shown, and I believe to more relevant disease models, such as collagen-induced arthritis. Thank you very much.
Excuse the question if it's a very bad one. Well, I was following Rawl's schedule, 2:30, I thought. I don't know. I didn't get the message. Anyway, is there any way of epidemiologically testing some of this? How, in an area, let's say, like Central Africa, where there's been a longer history of chronic parasitemia, unless I'm 1,000 degrees off, would there be a prediction of less autoimmune disorder?
I mean, what I would argue is that there's now very good reasons for looking for, you know, what's happening to arginine 57, the McDevitt suppressor allele, and other examples of dominantly mediated immunological unresponsiveness in the context of tropical disease, particularly in the context of hypersensitivity. You know, one would like to look at malaria patients who get, for example, interstitial renal disease as opposed to those who don't. Very much needs that kind of sophisticated HLA typing. I don't at all believe that the fact that Americans have been washing themselves now for, 50 years or so, the Germans have been washing themselves for about 100 years, and the Brits are going to start washing themselves soon. Means that these polymorphisms will disappear. I mean, look how long the polymorphisms imposed by malaria around the Mediterranean basin. It's centuries since. That's an exaggeration, but it's a long time since malaria was really endemic in Mediterranean basis, and its thalassemia is still bad news in Italy and Greece and southern Turkey. I think it's much too early to look for genetic effects.
Can I ask you to turn your mind to the possibility of dominant suppression in leukemia and cancer? One might at first sight think that if we were dealing with leukemogenic viruses, for example, that immune responses would invariably be protective. But I'm thinking particularly of some data that was published a short while ago by our colleagues, the Bodmers, in collaboration with clinical colleagues at Barts. And if you recall, they showed a skew in HLA-D polymorphisms in Hodgkin's disease. And I thought the most striking thing about that data was the gross underrepresentation of particular alleles. Now, I don't recall the details, But do you think, I mean, that's not quite what one would think at first sight if one was dealing with a leukemogenic virus, but do you think one could conclude from that that there are situations in cancer and perhaps some leukemias where the immune response to an organism is not protective but in fact promotes the development of leukemia or lymphoma? Would that be a reasonable conclusion to draw?
Well, Mel, I don't know that study, but to my regret. But why do you say that the immune response promotes it rather than suppression of an immune response promotes leukemia? Isn't that compatible with those
things? What I'm saying is that, well, it could be that way around, perhaps, but the lack of a particular allele could be lack of response, and the lack of response is a lack of promotion, and therefore, in effect, you're protected.
Yes, well, I mean, I think that's what we're arguing about, isn't it? Whether dominant unresponsiveness is a failure to make a response, or is a hole in the repertoire effect, or whether it's making a protective response through an inappropriate. Exactly. No. I'm delighted to hear that. So I know. I mean, my impression of the genetics of lymphoma is that it's all a bit of a mess, and that there were various HLA effects linkages have been published over the years. They tend to be not reproducible from one continent to another, and I'm also told, probably sort of rather at the level of gossip rather than looking at the data, that they seem to be effects on response to treatment rather than initial susceptibility.
Much of the older data was in treated patients, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes. You're going to get some help.
Yes. Am I pleased to see you?
It's not my question. It's rather reply, comments. As far as I know, we have already some attempts to model the polymorphism, extremely polymorphism, just in the loci of MHC, including their immune response genes as well as MHC1 class, have been already made by Thomas Nagelaki as well as François Bregeger, Thomas Nagelaki from United States and Bregeger from Paris. And also Tomoko Ota tried to model this situation, but without any influence from the natural selection, as in parasite-host situation conflicting, only on the basis of not so random, but without not selectively controlled processes such as oriented gene conversion. Just in this case, we have some very interesting, exciting examples, allelic and non-allelic conversions, shifted and non-shifted, symmetric or non-symmetric. In another case, in this situation, they were lucky, they succeeded to explain the real level of polymorphism in murine loci as well as in human. But as to the idea to join these two directions without selection and with selection caused by parasite-host interaction, it's a very complicated problem. That's why we prefer to analyze more simple situation with very clear and maybe purified relations, or a simplified situation, as in phage and bacteria. But maybe the as to potted models, it's very complicated. And as to computer simulation, they remain us to some extent disappointed, because we'd like to have analytical results as more convincing. Thank you.
Sergei, if I was a student of yours, if I was a really clever student of yours in Novosibirsk, I would take that kind of statement as an invitation to show you up as intellectually insufficiently ambitious and to prove that you're wrong and prove you that these difficult situations can be managed. I have enough confidence in the intellectual sieve which operates in Novosibirsk to believe that they're going to take up that challenge.
I think that's a good note to stop this session on. Just to say to Av, thanks again, Av, for a very stimulating session. And I think Dr. Staus is going to take over the chairmanship of the next session. Is he not, Rolf?
Something else again.
Okay. I think as a good rule and visitor by such a very special thing we had today a lecture which we never come over. The Pastor Bode lecture is only one time, like the Hans Eigenlecture. I think sometimes you need science and the character together. We had it 4 years ago with Bob, and today we have it with Ave. And so a friend of us, Michael Weidemann, tried to do something. He would be here, but he can talk about this. That's a pity, but I think we can show it to you. Maybe there is some picture for you, and Hannelore will show it to you. I think Oh, that's good. Maybe come in the right moment. Now you can explain your picture.
Thank you for coming.
All right. Well, hello everybody. Well, I'm just going to say a few words about Pastor Bode.
We get something about him, but you...
Did you already?
Yes, but that's well, you know him better.
Well, who was this William Bode, called the Vicar of the Heather? Who was this man who lived from 1860 till 1927? The son of a teacher from Lüneburg, had 9 brothers and sisters, but don't be afraid, I'm not going to tell you the whole story of his life. Well, I'm only going to pick up a few special items. It is sure that William Bode has not been a normal vicar in the sense what the church expected. He was much more an unconventional character who in his student's time took a drive with the circus for some months. A few years later, he became vicar in Egesdorf, a village a few miles from here, in the heart of the Heather of Lüneburg. The people liked him because he practically wanted to do something for them. So in 1888, William Bode founded the first savings and credit bank in this area, helping the farmers to sell their goods to a reasonable price. Under his command, the people of Underlo built a water pipe into their village, and it was connected to electricity. Remember that all was done by a man who actually was a vicar. But William Bode's actual importance for us today is that he has been a pioneer of environment protection. So in 1906, he bought the Death Valley, only a few miles from here, and 1910, the Wilseder Berg, with about 165 meters, the highest top in northern Germany. That was the beginning of this national preserved area, today called Natural Park Heather of Lüneburg. So in my watercolor, you see the Vicar Bode in the foreground, how he looked like when he was wandering around through the heather, a tall and heavy man with a penetrating glance. In the opposite, you see the second ego of William Bode, the visionary of environment protection. Maybe you will see him just around the corner after this lecture, hidden in a tree or up in the clouds. Remember, Wilseder and Underlo have been always William Bode's favorite places. So thank you.
Thank you very much, coming at the right time. Your view of Pastor Bode is a little bit different as Hannelore is. You have heard it in the beginning, but I think he has 2 pictures in himself, and it was good to hear you about your side. Thank you very much again for this, and I think thank you very much for this nice picture. And now we can go on with some science. I think we have a short immunology lesson around Elfenbüttelsen. I think Hans Strauss will share the session with 3 speakers. They will be all in time, I think mostly 20 minutes, and then we have a wonderful coffee break to talk about this picture.
Thank you.
Was?
The question is, she here at all, Pierce?
Yes.
Pierce, you are here. You start.
So I wasn't quite sure. But we'll start a session with the first presentation. Unfortunately, at the moment, I don't have a title, but just in a minute, we'll learn what it is about.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I didn't have a title prepared. I've kind of lost my voice over the last few days, and I want to thank the audience for all their medicinals that they've given to me, non-alcoholic, alcoholic, that have allowed me to at least turn into a frog and maybe get through this talk. I'd also like to really thank Rolf and everyone else that's organized this lovely meeting. Could I have my first slide, please? The work that I'm going to explain today involves signal transduction through oncogenes and foreign growth factor receptors transfected into interleukin-3-dependent myeloid progenitor cells or mast cells. I just have this slide up here sort of as a background slide to briefly discuss the work that I initially was involved in that got me interested in signaling pathways in lymphocyte mediated growth of mast cells. The work we did was to utilize fetal liver cells and propagate them in murine interleukin 3 in order to develop a population of cells that were relatively purified mast cells. And the question we wanted to ask was, would any oncogene be able to abrogate the growth factor dependence of these cells? And what we did was infected these cells with several retroviruses from different oncogene families, including those of the RAS family, the tyrosine kinase family, and the serine threonine family. And the Abelson virus, the one of the tyrosine kinase family, was the one that was capable of abrogating their growth factor dependence. These cells also became transformed once they were abrogated of factor dependence by Abelson virus. So the next question we asked in this respect was, how might this mechanism be working? And back in those days, IL-3 receptor wasn't cloned, and it was kind of a difficult question to ask. But we could eliminate one possibility, and that was that we did not find that autocrine production of interleukin 3 was induced by transformation by Abelson. So we could speculate that the Abelson tyrosine kinase oncogene was short-circuiting the growth factor receptor pathway of IL-3 in the normal mast cell. Could I have the next slide, please? So summary, the V-Abl oncogene abrogated factor dependence of the IL-3-dependent cells. It induced factor independence that was correlated with a transformed phenotype. The V-RAS and the V-MOS, or serine threonine type oncogenes, did not have this effect. And V-Abl induced IL-3 independence by a non-autocrine mechanism. Next slide, please. Shortly thereafter, several groups were able to demonstrate with utilizing various cell lines that were dependent on a variety of cytokines that other oncogenes were capable of doing the same thing. Working in the myeloid series, which is where the mast cell fits in, FDCP1 could be abrogated by a variety of tyrosine kinase type oncogenes. Macrophages could be abrogated by VFEMs and other tyrosine kinase. And the T cell and B cell lineage could be abrogated by Abel. And these are all tyrosine kinase oncogenes. The only one that has been demonstrated to induce abrogation of growth factor dependence outside of the tyrosine kinase family that I'm aware of is VMIC. And it's very interesting because it's a nuclear oncogene and may have a much more downstream effect in this process. And I don't think too many people have delved into the other nuclear oncogene, so I'd be very interested to see whether FOS, June, et cetera, would have this effect as well. Could I go on to the next slide, please? We decided at that point that we wanted to delve a little bit farther into signal transduction in this system, and we had several growth factor receptors cloned in our laboratory, and as you can see, I'm just, you know, have a little schematic of what signal transduction is all about, and how you know, we know what happens when the ligand attaches to the receptor, but what goes on downstream is where everybody is really trying to, you know, gain knowledge. And so we chose initially, in the next slide, I'm sorry, we chose to use the 32D cell line. It's a well-characterized murine IL-3-dependent cell line. It's normal diploid karyotype. It's non-tumorigenic. It's very IL-3-dependent for growth. It is, in my hands, impossible to get factor-independent variants spontaneously. And it differentiates to mature granulocytes in the presence of GCSF. So it endogenously expresses GCSF receptors as well as endogenously expressing, of course, IL-3 receptors. We also knew that the tyrosine kinase oncogenes were capable of abrogating this line of factor dependence. So we decided to try to induce a foreign growth factor receptor to ask the question whether or not the intracellular components were present in these cells, which would allow a signal to occur. Could I have the next slide, please? So we chose the EGF receptor. It's been probably the most well-characterized of all the tyrosine kinase receptors, and was available in our laboratory, and has an oncogenic counterpart, the VRB gene, which is a truncated version of EGF receptor and is a tyrosine kinase as well. I'll later try to briefly mention about the other types of tyrosine kinase receptors we put in the cells, the CSF1 receptor and the PDGF receptors. Next slide, please. We used electroporation as the method to put the EGF receptor or the VRB gene into 32D cells. And this is just to show you that it's a very potent method of getting genes in. We use a selectable marker linked on the plasmid, and we're able to get levels of EGF receptor present on the surface of 32D cells that were not quite as good as A431, but and probably most of you don't know, but A431 cells express over 1 million EGF receptors per cell. So we're talking very high level of receptor in the cell after electroporation. VRB doesn't show a positive response in this binding assay because it's truncated at the ligand binding domain, so it can't bind EGF. Next slide, please. So the bottom line question, of course, was would the 32D cells transfected with the EGF receptor be able to signal and mitogenically respond to EGF? And the answer was yes. You can see that in the bottom part of the slide, that EGF itself would work almost as well as IL-3 for inducing thymidine uptake and cloning efficiency. VRB, as I had expected, was capable. Thank you very much. Was capable of abrogating the growth factor dependence, so these cells would grow without any addition of exogenous growth factors. Next slide, please. Oops, this one's upside down. What I want to talk about here is a very interesting phenomenon that we observed. When we put the EGF receptor into 32D cells and triggered them with EGF, we saw striking morphological alterations in culture. And I decided it would be very interesting to look at whether or not EGF may be inducing differentiation of these myeloid progenitor cells, since we knew they were capable of being induced to differentiate to granulocytes in the presence of GCSF. And all this is fax analysis. And what we found was the line went towards the monocytic lineage rather than the granulocytic lineage. We got a great increase in MAC1, slight increase in MAC2, MAC3, FC, and IA, and this is just the negative control. So the tyrosine kinase, at least the EGF tyrosine kinase signaling pathway, was inducing monocytic differentiation in these cells. Next slide, please. We tried to delve into whether or not we could see differences in second messenger systems that might be a reason why we were seeing monocytic differentiation in response to EGF versus proliferation in response to IL-3. And we did find that in the presence of EGF, phosphoinositol turnover was greatly induced, and in the presence of IL-3, no PI turnover was seen at all. And I don't think with most of the hematopoietic cytokines, there has been any reports of PI turnover being induced, so this was somewhat expected. But at least we were able to show a biochemical difference that is indirectly related to signaling pathways within the cell that we had at that time thought might be responsible for this difference in the proliferation versus differentiation. Next slide, please. So sort of in summary, IL-3 will induce 32Ds to proliferate. They don't mature at all. They stay as a myeloid precursor. 32Z cells in the presence of EGF will proliferate and differentiate, and without anything at all, of course, they are still factor dependent, they don't grow. So they do need one of the other ligands to grow, and of course, the ERBB gene will abrogate their growth factor dependence, acting as a constitutive tyrosine kinase. Next slide, please. We can skip this one, go ahead. Next slide. We went on to look at the PDGF receptor. It's a novel tyrosine kinase receptor in the respect that there are really two PDGF receptors. One was cloned in our lab last year by Toshimitsu Matsui, and it's called the alpha PDGF receptor. The difference between EGF receptor and PDGF receptor-like molecules, or CFEMS-type molecules, that tyrosine kinase region has an interspersing domain that's called the interkinase insert region, and no one really knows what the use of this region is. Some of the work in our lab seems to think that it really doesn't do much of anything. But at any rate, because of the fact that there were two independent forms of PDGF receptors that were related but not the same gene, we wanted to determine, and using 32D cells as the naive cell, whether or not that both genes were necessary to be expressed for signaling, or the ligands for PDGF, which include two different genes, the A chain and the B chain, which is V-cis, which form homo or heterodimers, which would signal through which of the two or both at the same time, sort of in the sense of whether or not it was an IL-2 receptor type situation. Next slide, please. This just shows we got nice expression as usual by this method. Next slide. So what we found was that the PDGF beta receptor could signal for mitogenicity really well in 32D cells transfected with the beta receptor in response to BB, and the alpha receptor also was able to signal through BB. This is an anomaly. We've come to be able to get our hands on much purer PDGF-AB, and the beta receptor does not respond at all to AB. The alpha receptor, by contrast, responds very well to AB, and again, it also responds to AA, but not to A, and the beta receptor does not respond to AA at all. So the lesson to be learned from this is that this system could be utilized to dissect not only that two receptors were not necessary, but which ligands would signal through which of the two receptors. Next slide, please. We were able to, you know, try to determine several of the known function of PDGF and other systems, whether they would act the same way in 32D cells, and yes, they would chemotact. Next slide, please. They would induce phosphoinositol turnover. And I should mention, when I say that they, for people that may be interested in PDGF, that we found that the AA homodimer was capable of chemoattracting the alpha receptor 32D cells. So anything that would work mitogenically would also work in all these other systems that we looked into, such as PI turnover and calcium flux. Next slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry, again, it's upside down. So just to summarize, The alpha or beta PDGF receptors are independently capable of coupling with signal transduction pathways inherently present in 32D cells. PDGF activation of 32D alpha or beta receptor cells results in monogenicity, chemotaxis, inositol phosphate metabolism, mobilization of intracellular calcium. I'll also say here, and at the time that we were doing these experiments, I didn't know, they do induce monocytic differentiation as well. PDGF-AA and AB preferentially trigger functional responses in the 32D alpha, while the BB functions with comparable efficiency in both receptor cell lines. Thus, the availability of the specific PDGF isoform and the relative level of the receptor expressed by the specific cell must be the major determinant regulating PDGF response. Since there's not a real oncogenic version of the PDGF receptors, we super transfected these cells with CRV cis and were able to, again, in an autocrine fashion, show that you could induce tumorigenicity and abrogate IL-3 dependence. Next slide, please. We went on then to just to throw one more receptor in, because at this point I was beginning to get excited about the differentiation potential of this system, and we used the CSF1 receptor. Of course, you all know this is a tyrosine kinase and is a hematopoietic receptor, but it is not present on 32D cells normally. I think they're too immature. They're myeloid progenitor cells, and I just put this up to remind me this is where we were turning to. They again will signal and. And this is a point mutated version of the CSF1 receptor, also called CFEMS. It's the proto-oncogene that Chuck Scheer matched with the CSF1 receptor. And what he did was he put two point mutations in CFEMS, which constitutively activate it so that it acts, again, like an oncogene. And again, will abrogate growth factor dependence. Next slide, please. Most interestingly, this is the type of biological events that you see in culture when you look at these cells either triggered with IL-3 or CSF1. Growing in soft agar, IL-3-induced cells grow as a very compact colony. Growing in CSF1, very diffuse. IL-3-growing cells are very grow in suspension. The CSF1-induced cells attach to the to the surface of the plate, and the IL-3-growing cells are very immature and look much more macrophage-like when you put them into CSF1. Next slide, please. So we then started to we had done this also with the EGF receptor, but we looked at all these panel of different histochemical and cell surface markers, and again, we found that all the monocytic markers were elevated in response to CSF1, of course, none in response to GCSF or IL-3. The 32D CFEM cells that are constitutively activated, the oncogenic version, also displayed these increased monocytic markers. And then we looked at cell surface markers as well and found an increase. The only thing we didn't find was that they didn't have was the ability to phagocytose. And so therefore they really hadn't reached a terminally differentiated state as a macrophage. Next slide, please. So we asked the question, since these cells were growing in IL-3, you put them into CSF1, they differentiate quite far down the line towards the monocytic lineage. Could you bring them back? And this is something that I know most hematologists the dogma is once they start going down lineage and they get as close as these cells were to macrophage, trying to turn them back into a primitive progenitor cell is difficult. So I went to a lot of trouble. I induced the cells with CSF1, cells sorted for the highest level of MAC1, MAC2, and MAC3 on the differentiated cells, and took the top 2% of the sorted cells, then put them either into CSF1 or IL-3. And as you can see, if you put them into IL-3, they progressively go back and become immature, and within a week they basically lost all the markers they've gained during CSF1 induction of differentiation. Next slide, please. And I also would like to say that Don Metcalf and Larry Warschneider have done some nice work in this, in the same, along the same line. So I was a little worried about what I had done, and essentially they've done the same thing. So I guess it may be right, at least in cell lines. So in summary on FEMS, introduction of CSF1 receptor into 32D cells allows CSF1 to induce mitogenicity and long-term proliferation. CSF1 induces synchronous differentiation of the cells to a specific stage within the monocyte macrophage lineage. The differentiation can be reversed with withdrawal of IL-3 and addition of CSF1. It's a potent chemoattractant, which I guess I didn't mention, and serves to, and I guess this really was sort of a controversial issue. I don't know whether a lot of papers had been written which really had definitively shown that CSF1 could chemoattract cells expressing the receptor, suggesting that CSF1 might serve to recruit monocytes from the bloodstream to situ sites of, I'm losing my voice, sites of inflammation or injury, and at that point become macrophages when they reach the tissue site. And then again, the expression of the point mutated CSF1, which possesses the constitutive tyrosine kinase activity, abrogates IL-3 independence and induces tumor, but does not block the monocyte differentiation of the 32D cells. Next slide, please. Now, this slide is, again, a little old, but what I'm trying to do right now is this. We have sort of trying to look at the pattern of what's going on in these cells. We find that EGF, PDGF, CSF1, and IL-3 all induce mitogenicity. GCSF, of course, does, because you have to have some rounds of division when you're terminally differentiating a cell to a neutrophil. EGF, PDGF, and CSF1 are all chemotactic, whereas IL-3 and GCSF are not. Monocytic differentiation is positive for EGF, PDGF, and CSF1, and granulocytic differentiation is only induced by GCSF. PI metabolism, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to correlate with the induction of monocytic differentiation, because this plus minus is really a minus now. And we saw inklings of a possible very small induction of PI in the cells, but it's not real. So PI metabolism in response to CSF1 does not occur. What we've also done recently is put the erythropoietin receptor into these cells, and as you all know, these new group of cytokine receptors do not contain tyrosine kinase domains, and when you put EPO into 32D cells, they don't differentiate at all. They just continue to proliferate and act as though they're growing in IL-3. So what we're going to try to do at this point is to look at cellular substrates that might be phosphorylated in response to tyrosine consensus substrates such as GAP, PLC, and RAF for the tyrosine kinases, see if any of those are induced by IL-3, EPO, or GCSF, and maybe look at gene regulation that might be controlled by transcriptional factors particular to these cells. That's all. Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask one question to a GCD differentiation after CSF1 induction. Do you need to have certain other factors around, or is it just sufficient to leave CSF1 away?
No, you remove the CSF1 and put them back into IL-3. If you remove the CSF1 from the cells that are CSF1 receptor positive, they'll die. They won't do anything. They'll just die. But no, you have to put them back into IL-3 to de-differentiate them. I don't know what would happen with EPO, but these are kind of the types of questions I'd like to ask in the near future. Dick? I think that the answer to your question is probably it is not a rare cell, and I have several reasons for that. One is that I've picked by cell sorting cells that have gone so far down the lineage that I don't know where that one rare cell would have had to be, really maybe one cell. And when you put them back into IL-3, you see the whole populations come off the plastic, synchronously lose those markers. It happens rather quickly. And the only thing more I could have done was clone the cell that I cell sorted on a single cell basis. If you keep those cells in CSF1 after sorting for this, you know, the most mature phenotype, they continually keep that phenotype. So I think the answer is they're really the whole population is really de-differentiation, and it isn't a rare event of one cell that I missed. But I, you know, I could be wrong.
Okay.
After de-differentiation? Yeah, you can push them back and forth. Yep.
Can you make them express erythropoietin receptors or GM-CSF receptors?
You can, the question would be if you put them back, if you pull them back from the mature monocytic state that has been developed by CSF1 in, let's say, IL-3, can you induce them to become a granulocyte in response to GCSF? And the answer to that is yes. If you try to make them become a granulocyte when they've been pushed down the monocytic lineage, they're not going to jump over to the other side. Nick. Didn't work in my hands.
So when you try to revert these cells, have they actually went into a real terminal differentiation in the sense that the cell cycling had gone through, so they were G0 cells or resting cells?
No, they continue to grow at a very slow rate. They aren't terminally differentiated to the point where they've actually stopped dividing completely.
But you would have cells which actually had gone into G0, G1 rest, if they, in this population?
It's possible that when they die, I don't see them, yeah.
Because that could explain the versatility.
Right. This is true.
One last question.
That's correct. Everybody asked me that one. The